for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Some call him a provocateur. Others say he's a gadfly, but there is no denying his films have been popular. Michael Moore's most recent documentary, Capitalism, A Love Story, now on DVD, shone a bright light on the enormous greed and gross inequities that brought our financial system to the brink of collapse in 2008. Michael Moore joins me in the studio to talk about lessons learned and what he thinks we can and should do to fix what he says is a very broken system. You can join us. Questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet. Join us on Facebook. And do check out our brand new redesigned website at drshow.org. Michael Moore, it's good to meet you.
It's great to meet you. I'm honored to be here. I love the show.
Thank you. I'm glad you do. This is such an important week in Washington for two issues that I know are important to you. One is health care overhaul. The other is financial reform. Take financial reform first, and Senator Chris Dodd's proposals, what do you think?
I don't think much of them. And I wouldn't call them reform. They're a watered-down version of what President Obama proposed. They don't really do the things that need to be done to prevent the next collapse. I'll give you probably one of the best examples is that banks or institutions that have over $50 billion in assets won't be part of this. They'll still be under the Fed. Well, that's who caused this whole thing. So right away, right out of the gate, if it isn't going to regulate the very banks and financial institutions that caused the mess, where are we at? The so-called Consumer Financial Protection Agency that they're going to establish won't have any real teeth, and it's going to be housed at the Fed. They're gonna put the chickens in where the fox is. So I don't think it's real reform. It's Senator Dodd. This is the part I don't understand about him. You know, he's not running for re-election. He had some trouble last year with questions raised about the sweetheart loans from Countrywide Financial, an institution he was supposed to be overseeing as the head of the banking committee. The banking committee has received, approximately $41 million has been spent on lobbying just the banking committee that he chairs by Wall Street. That's how much they've spent. That's out of a total of around $400 million in the last year that they've spent lobbying Capitol Hill to make sure that to this day, 18 months after the crash, not one single regulation or rule has been put back in place to prevent the next crash. And in fact, they're back to trading the crazy derivatives and credit default swaps and all the other stuff that brought this about.
So would you have been in favor of a consumer protection organization?
Oh, absolutely.
Placed elsewhere.
Yes, and a strong one with teeth, with real...
Placed where?
Placed as it's part of its own agency,
independent.
It can be part of the Department of Treasury, but something where you and I have some sort of control, because we can contact our elected representatives. I really can't call the Fed. I don't know if you knew this, but I have absolutely no influence there, and neither do you or anybody else listening to this show. So that's not good in a democracy to remove the watchdog from us and place it with the very people the watchdog should be watching.
And on health care, candidate Obama seemed so strong.
Yeah.
Are you, as many people are, disappointed?
I'm very disappointed. I know that in his heart, he believes that every American, when they get sick, should have the right to see a doctor and not have to worry about being able to pay for it. The fact that that's not what we're going to have, that we're going to have, again, a watered-down bill that does a few good things. For instance, parents can keep their kids on their health insurance policy till they're 26 years old. That's a really good thing, especially in this economy.
Can't cut you out for a pre-existing condition.
Starting in 2014.
Right.
For children, at 6 months after the bill's passed, pre-existing condition, but not for adults. There's a reason on the airplane where they tell you to put your oxygen mask on first before you put it on the kids, because if you pass out, you can't help the kids. It makes absolutely no sense that we go another 4 years denying adults insurance simply because they had a pre-existing condition. So essentially we say, yeah, it's okay if a few thousand of these parents die, but at least the kids will be insured. I just think that is such crazy thinking. And here's the other thing about this pre-existing condition. Everybody thinks, oh, this is so great. We're going to stop the pre-existing condition. Do you know what it says in the bill in terms of, let's say your health insurance company just decides, you know, I'm sorry, we're not going to insure you because of your pre-existing. I mean, in other words, they decide to violate the law. What's the penalty? $100 a day. $100 a day per person. I mean, can you imagine if you're there running the insurance company, you're going, let's see, Diane needs an operation that's going to cost $100,000. But if we take the $100 fine a day for a year, that's only $36,500. Hey, let's just break the law and take the fine. I mean, this is not real reform.
But is it something to build on?
Well, yes. Obviously, it's a step. I mean, anything in that direction is a good thing.
And look how hard it's been to get. They're
yes.
still debating votes even as we speak.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, how about the fact that since Hillary and Bill tried to do something about this some 16 years ago, it hasn't even been on the national agenda. We haven't even been able to talk about it. This is something Franklin Roosevelt wanted to have happen. We've been fighting for this for so many years. I realize no bill is going to be what Michael Moore wants it to be. But boy, I was sure hoping for a lot better than this. We're still, this bill will not cover at least 12 million people, will still be uninsured. It's going to have this so-called mandatory thing where you're going to be forced to buy it. And again, this is such a boon to the insurance companies, Diane. Think about this. Imagine passing a law that requires everybody to buy your product. Or let's say if we had got a law passed that required everybody had to listen to the Diane Rehm show every day. You know, or contribute $100.
I'd like that law.
Yes, right. Of course you
right.
would. And I would like a law while we're at it that everybody has to go see my next movie.
Of course.
And I'll tell you what, that's going to make me a lot of money if I could just get that. So you can see. So the question is, why are the insurance companies so opposed to this watered down legislation? And it's because they're only getting 90% of what they want. They want 100%. This is how greed works, especially in the age of greed that we live in. They've got to have it all. So because there is this pre-existing condition rule that's going to be in place, and because the kids can be kept on until they're 26, and some of the things they don't like, then they're opposed to the bill, even though the bill is going to guarantee money in their pocket by forcing people to have to buy health insurance.
So, Michael Moore, you were not too flattering or pleased about the prior administration. How are you feeling about the Obama administration? Did the president do enough to get the important things into this health care bill?
No, he shot out of the gate with compromise right from the very beginning. Now, on some level, you have to say, well, you know, that's because he's a decent guy. I really, truly believe he came to this town with the attitude of wanting to work with the other side. I don't think he's an ideologue. I don't think he's a guy who's in cement. I mean, that's, in some ways, a good thing about him because he is generous of spirit. The other side, unfortunately, doesn't reciprocate the generosity of spirit. And they're just going to vote no on no matter what he is doing, what he proposes or whatever. And he should have just come into town and said, look, I'm sorry, but we're going to do this just like you do it when you come into town. This is what you have to admire, really, about the Republicans. When they come into power here, they barrel down Pennsylvania Avenue in their Hummer and knock everybody out of the way, guns blazing. And they say, this is what we're going to do. These are the laws we're going to pass and get out of my way. And they get it done. And this is what is so frustrating if you're on the other side of the political fence, is that our team is all like kumbaya and, well, can't we all get along? And it's like, no, they don't want to get along. So the American people have sent you to Washington by pretty large numbers to do a job. So do the job. And yes, some people aren't going to like it. And yes, some of you may not get reelected. But that's okay. That's not what you're here for. You're here to do the job you were sent here to do. And they haven't done the job when it comes to real health care reform. And remember the words universal health care, where every American would be covered? We don't even say that anymore. We don't even talk about it. They haven't done a single thing about the regulations being just put back in place. Dodd said the other day, well, we don't want to punish Wall Street. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. They stole billions of dollars. The fact that they haven't been punished has only told them that it's okay to go back to the old way of doing things, which
and
is what they've done.
And you see them going back exactly
not just me.
To the old ways.
A lot of economists are like very worried that they're back to doing all this crazy gambling with your pension fund, with people's money, and the chance of another collapse happening is significant. And why this town doesn't do something about that, why? What am I saying? I know why. It's that $400 million of lobbying money that's been spent here in the last little over a year.
It's also the talk show host.
Which talk show host?
Conservative talk show host.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a steady drumbeat every day on a certain television network and much of talk radio.
Michael Moore, director and producer of Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, Sicko, and Capitalism, a Love Story. He is an author, liberal, and political commentator. Welcome back. Michael Moore is with me for the hour. I know many of you have questions you'd like to pose. We've got tons of email. We'll get to them in just a few moments. Michael Moore, I want to know about you. I would like to hear about your background, how you came to arrive at the conclusions you have, what your parents were like, what your family is like. I want to hear about you.
Hmm. Well, my parents were Frank and Veronica Moore. My dad is still with us. He'll be 89 in August.
Oh, I'm glad.
Goes to Mass every morning, and then he goes over to the church gym and works out for an hour.
Wow.
Something that his son should probably take after and pay attention to.
Next day.
I was raised in an Irish Catholic household. I went to Catholic schools. I went to the seminary when I was in high school. I wanted to be a Catholic priest. I was raised with a belief system that said we would be judged by how we treat the least among us, and the rich man's going to have a hard time getting into heaven if he doesn't do some good for others, a lot of good. And so I was raised with these principles and beliefs. I also had a cousin who lived in New York City. My mom's sister was her mom, and her dad was a state assemblyman in New York. And so she would come to Flint every summer. and talk politics to us, and they were all part of the whole, when Kennedy was inaugurated and elected, you know, we had, you know, there was a big, you know, for Irish Catholic families was a big deal.
You bet.
And it really, I remember at an early age paying close attention, you know, to all of this. And so my dad worked on the assembly line at General Motors for 34 years. My mom was a secretary in the township hall. And that's, you know, I have two sisters. That's how I was raised. I was raised with these principles and beliefs, and also with that sort of Irish, you know, kind of sensibility and sense of humor where, you know, if you don't learn to, the sort of the dark, the way the world is, if you don't learn to laugh at it, you end up drinking too much, I guess. So I chose not to drink. And you know, it's funny, actually, I was thinking about this the other day. The my last year in high school, my last week of my senior year in high school, two things happened. The senior class elected me class comic, and the town elected me to the Board of Education. And I became the first 18-year-old in the state of Michigan elected to public office in 1972, right after 18-year-olds were given the right to vote. And I was thinking in that 1 week sort of represented the two, the dichotomy, I don't know if it's a dichotomy, but the two sides of, I guess, of where my, or how I'm wired in terms of politically, and but also seeing the need for humor and satire and these things that have sort of permeated my work.
Do you still regard yourself as a religious person, a practicing Catholic?
I go to Mass on Sunday. I would put myself more in the category of recovering Catholic. You know, religious, I'm not one to wear this on my sleeve, and I don't really, I think it's a very personal thing, religion, but I do, but in this film, actually, for the first time I really talk about, I went to see the priest that married my wife and I, to talk to him about, you know, would Jesus belong to a hedge fund? And we had a very interesting conversation about capitalism and Christianity and how they seem to not really be in sync with each other because capitalism and, well, Christianity is, Jesus said everybody's supposed to have a seat at the table. And everybody, we're supposed to divide that pie in some sort of fair manner. Capitalism has become a system where one guy takes nine slices of the pie and the other nine people at the table are supposed to fight over the last slice. And then, and in fact, those are the facts. The richest 1% in this country control more financial wealth than the bottom 95% combined. 1%, more than 95%. And yet, so I think anthropologists and historians hundreds of years from now, assuming the planet—
They're going to wonder.
Well, they're going to wonder how these— look at
how
these,
did it happen?
How did it happen? And how did the, why were these people calling themselves part of a democracy when the wealthiest 1% were really making the true decisions?
Let me go back to religion for just a moment and the scandals that have taken place, not only in this country, but even in Ireland.
Yeah.
We hear that the bishop there has apparently been accused of overlooking or...
Not just overlooking. That's a crime. When you cover up a felony, you're a criminal. And I say this now very strongly as a Catholic, that crimes were committed and crimes are covered up. In fact, the current pope helped to write the policy for the last pope, helped to participate in his own way in the cover-up. And it is amazing to me that more of them are not in prison. The pedophile is someone who's sick and needs help. No amount of prison is going to cure that. Pedophiles and people like that need to be removed from the rest of us so they don't hurt other children. But those in charge, the bishops, who weren't pedophiles themselves necessarily, but covered up the pedophilia and shifted the priests around to do these things, in some ways, I think they committed a worse crime because they're not operating out of a mental illness. They're operating out of cold, calculated political and financial judgment. And Diane, I'm telling you, if this was anything else besides the Catholic Church, let's say it was discovered that the Kiwanis clubs all across America, the presidents of all the local Kiwanis clubs, not all of them, but thousands of them in the case of how many priests have been brought up on these charges, were found to be raping children. you know, how long would these Kiwanis clubs, I mean, the people in town, there'd be torches lit. The doors of these places would be bolted shut. They've only gotten away with it because they've been hiding behind God. And it has been so frustrating and upsetting to me personally that this cover-up has taken place. And frankly, people have not paid the price for this.
But you still attend Sunday morning Mass.
Yes, because, well, you have to, I guess you have to find a church and a priest that, you know, in my case, meets my own personal needs. Because I separate, obviously, the fact that the teachings of Jesus are not necessarily the teachings of the institution. Here's the best example. I mean, the Catholic Church has led the fight against people who happen to be gay or lesbian. They've led the fight against abortion and trying to control women and their decisions about what to do with their bodies. And yet nowhere in the Bible, nowhere in the New Testament, does Jesus say one single word about homosexuality or abortion. Not a word. He had bigger fish to fry, other things on his mind about how the poor were to be treated, how we are to treat our neighbor, how we're to love our enemy. You know, he never talked about these things. He has been used as a club by certain people who call themselves Christians to beat down other people who find themselves either in the predicament of an unwanted pregnancy or simply because of their birth. They happen to be gay or lesbian.
So you are still involved with a church that teaches these things.
I still believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ, and I try to live my life as best as I can according to those principles without holding myself up as anything other than a flawed human being. But as far as the institution itself, I find myself in deep despair about what the institution has done under the guise of the teachings of Jesus Christ.
Tell me about your wife and family.
My wife has produced most of my stuff for my 20 years of being a filmmaker, and we've done this together. She produced our two TV shows.
How did
TV
it
Nation.
Begin?
I first met her in. She's probably listening to this right now, going, "Okay."
I hope so.
She's going to put the brakes on it, buddy. I met her the first time I met her. She was 17 years old. We were both from the school district I went to. She went to the one right next to it, the high school.
Same time.
Yeah, she's 4 years younger than I am.
Okay.
I've known her for a very very long time, and we've been together for quite some time now. And it, you know, I mean, it's I've been very fortunate to have this life and to be with her. There's so many things about her. She now is she's an artist and. She makes these incredible quilts and does this quilt art that's completely awesome, and she's a private person, and my family, they're private people, and I try to protect them as much as possible.
Children,
we have a daughter, she's just gone back to school to do some graduate work, and. So very proud of her. And, you know, we lived actually here in D.C. for about 3 years in the mid to late 80s. And our daughter went over here to John Eaton Elementary right over in the neighborhood.
I know
here.
It well.
Right. You know the kind of school I'm talking about? And we lived on Cortland Place just off Connecticut there. We'd walk over to the zoo and the Uptown Theater and really enjoyed. I love this town. I loved living here as a family. It was a friendly place.
Your films have been quite provocative. Have you?
You think so? No, seriously. I mean, I people say that, and I wonder, geez, what is it that is so provocative about not wanting kids to go into schools and shoot them up with assault weapons that they had access to? Or what's so provocative
it's
about?
It's good provocative because it makes people think.
Oh, well, then that's good. Okay.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, because sometimes I think I choose some very conservative subjects. Like if a company like General Motors, my first film, is making record profits, as they were when I made the film, Why are they laying off people? This seems really dumb, because if they lay off the middle class, who are the people that are going to buy their cars, if they don't have the money to buy their cars, how are they going to make any money? How are they going to survive as a company? It seemed to make no sense to me. But they figured, well, but if we laid these people off and we did it in Mexico, you know, we could save this money. Well, yeah, I guess you could save the money while you're making it, but you've left behind people who no longer can buy a Buick. So you're slitting your own throats. So I made Sicko because I thought everybody should be able to see a doctor and not have to worry about whether or not they can pay for it. I mean, that's the provocative thought there. Is that provocative? I don't know.
I think it's provocative because you make people think. You make people question their own assumptions and judgments about the news as they are presented with it. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about Toyota right now.
They're going through their GM experience. I mean, basically, they became number one. They surpassed General Motors and Ford. And then they started acting like number one. They got to number one because they built a car that didn't fall apart. It was a safe car. It wasn't a gas-guzzling car. And that's how they built up a loyal a group of owners across the country.
There are some people who are suggesting that people who've had this unwanted or unintended acceleration are doing it for the money or for the publicity.
Well, that could be true. But I think Toyota has admitted that they decided to save. I mean, this is what happened with General Motors, too. Whenever they go, geez, should we spend 10 cents on this part or 5 cents on this part? Let's spend 5 cents. We can make more money. Because that's what it's about. It's about profit. It's about returning money to the shareholders as opposed to quality. And so they became like GM when they adopted that attitude, and now they're suffering the consequences of that. As far as the runaway Toyota at 93 miles an hour on the California freeway, I don't know about that.
Really? You have some questions.
Yeah. It seems a little, you know, Ghost Rider to me.
Ghost Rider.
Well, I mean, I come from a car town. I know something about cars. I know that that's almost impossible unless, one of those vampires from Twilight is driving the car.
What about the trooper who went into the water?
No, there have been problems. I mean, Toyota's admitted that there have been problems with some of their cars, but you know, they'll get people back if they start to behave like they used to behave. I mean, look, this is why GM went down, because people got sick and tired of, you buy a GM car, and within 2 weeks, the glove compartment door is falling down. It won't stay back up. And you don't want to have a personal relationship with Mr. Goodwrench.
Michael Moore, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you. Let's go first to Fairport, New York. Judy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the show, and thank you, Michael Moore. I read your email this morning. I saw your movie, Sicko. The only criticism I have of Sicko was I did hear on NPR that in Cuba they can knock on your door and take an organ. However, I still appreciate that movie. I believe that our healthcare system is very flawed. I wonder if I would hate to think that this is the reason, but why find a cure for chronic illness when the pharmaceutical companies can make so much money on the illness and suffering of others? I have a very close person to me who's has a chronic illness, and the medicine is over $1,000 a month.
Ugh.
And that is criminal. And also, I also tried to find a cure for the illness, and I realized that the only place that's doing any research of any value is Germany. I work at a hospital, and there's a nurse practitioner there, and I've asked him about the problem of healthcare in our country. I said, is it ignorance? He said, no, it's arrogance.
Well, I'm really, first of all, I'm very sorry to hear about what you're going through. Not a day goes by in my life where I don't get stopped by someone like you, more than just one person, to tell me a story like this. And no one can understand why the wealthiest country on earth can't figure out this problem and why you should have to suffer. It's a human right. It should be a human right for your friend to be able to get this treatment. What this new bill is going to do is, even though eventually by 2014 they won't be able to deny you because of a pre-existing condition, once you have the insurance, they will be able to still deny you treatment. And they will be able to say, for instance, like perhaps in this case, this is experimental, this treatment, the one they're doing in Germany. We don't do that here. We don't cover it. And they'll be able to do that and not be fined for it. I'm very sorry. Please, I hope everything goes well, and we'll pray for you.
Judy, thank you so much for calling. Take care of yourself and your friend, and stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Emily and Antoine von Ochtmal, supporting New Futures, a D.C.-based organization committed to transforming lives through learning. By the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
President Bush called him the architect of his re-election victory. He's also been called Bush's brain. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Karl Rove. He's written a new memoir called Courage and Consequence, My Life as a Conservative in the Fight. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. Michael Moore is here in the studio. Let's go back to the phones to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Walter. You're on the air.
Good morning. I admire myself for fighting for health care reform for the last two or three years, but I admire you more and Barack Obama because, in my case, I'm self-employed and I don't have insurance, so I have a reason to fight. But I admired men like you who don't need to fight for causes like this because I know you're a comfortable man. That's why I know Barack Obama is a good man because he does not need health care reform. But I want to say, I saw Sicko. It made a huge impression on me. I tell people all the time to see it. Unfortunately, sir, you are perceived as a satirist as opposed to a scholar, and people have already got their mindset that Saturday Night Live is just comedy. I'm afraid too many people think of you not as the intelligent man and compassionate man that you are, but as more of a comedian. And I don't know what you can do to change that perception, but I do think...
I know what you're saying. We've reached a point in this country where satire is, and comedy in general is trivialized in that way. We don't really place it in the way that in the days of Mark Twain, I mean, he was a satirist, but was also considered somebody who had some very important things to say about the social condition. And that dates all the way back to Jonathan Swift.
But you said that conservatives have created a picture of you.
Yes. I mean, one of the problems I guess I have is that with probably 20% of the population who is hardcore, listens to Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and whatever, those entities have created a fictional character using my name. And I hear things. I used to laugh when I first heard them talk about me and this and that, whatever. And it was kind of funny, I thought. And then I thought, oh, my God, people are actually believing this. I mean, they don't. And I think that led to, in this last film here, of me wanting to say a little bit more about myself personally, because, number one, I'm actually in many ways a very conservative person. My grandfather was one of the leaders of the Republican Party in the county that we grew up in. He taught us that being conservative meant that you conserve the air, you conserve the water, you conserve the environment. You do not spend money you don't have. You conserve your financial resources. So here I am, somebody who I think is, I live a fairly conservative, quiet life. I go to mass. I'm with the same woman for the last 30 years. I'm an Eagle Scout. There's all these things that they don't talk about on Fox News when they talk about Michael Moore. And mainly you have to understand the reason is because they're so upset that my work has reached such a wide mainstream audience.
They want to push you aside.
They want me out on that left limb as far as possible to marginalize me. Why don't they go after others, say, on the left? Well, because sadly, many of those people on the left don't reach them. They're not on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. They're not talking to a middle audience, a big audience in middle America. And that's my audience. And that frightens them. So I understand why they have to attack me personally, but I don't feel that way toward them. I've never uttered the words, I hate George W. Bush. I never would say that. I would never lower myself to a level like that. I'll disagree vehemently with his policies and his decisions and debate the politics of it. But to demonize him as a human being, I just think, I hope I don't go there. I don't want to go there because I don't want to be on that level.
How comfortable financially are you?
Well, for a documentary filmmaker, I'm probably better off than any documentary filmmaker in this country. And so when he says, I don't have to be fighting for these things, I guess I didn't really think of it that way. But when he said that, I thought, geez, that's right. I belong to the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, and SAG. So I have three different unions and three different health insurance policies. I only need one. So it's like, wow. I mean, I am in a very privileged position in that way. But the way I was raised, Diane, as I explained earlier, is that if you are fortunate in life to be able to have that success, you are even more responsible with how you spend your time and your money and your efforts if you've been able to somehow, and listen, I'm from the working class, I have a high school education, that's it. I was able to somehow get through the door, and my attitude was, wow, I'm through the door. I'm going to hold that door open as long as I can and bring as many people through that door with me as possible.
The one difference, however, is that you are politically free. Barack Obama yesterday on Rush Limbaugh's program was called a third world president.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have two things to say about that. We have not really, we really haven't dealt with race to the extent that I would hope we would have dealt with by now, at least my generation and older. The younger kids, they're so much better with this.
Right.
I'm so hopeful. I see my daughter, I see her friends, I see the young people that work on my films. Wow, there's hope. I totally believe that. And it was the young people that really got behind Obama. They made that.
Absolutely.
They made Iowa happen, that first victory of his. That was the young people who got out there and did that. the sort of the overt and covert subvert racism that exists in these discussions about President Obama. It's sad to have to, but when Limbaugh and these guys refer to him as being the president of a third world country, well, it's in some ways it's an accurate statement, because America, in many ways, if you go to the Flint, Michigans of this country, is a third world country, and it has been created by the policies of administrations over the years that have lined the pockets of the wealthy at the expense of the working people who built those cars, who made that steel, who grew the crops. And they are the ones who they've been punished. They've been punished for creating this country. They created this country. And now they have to suffer through this. They have one out of eight homes now is in foreclosure or delinquency. There's a foreclosure filing once every 8 seconds in this country right now. 10,000 people a day have their health insurance taken away from them, or they lose it because they've lost their job. 10,000 a day. I mean, to attack these people more for creating the American dream, it is so repulsive and repugnant. I just wonder, how long do the wealthy of this country think that the working people of this country are going to put up with this? I mean, really, truly, how long do you think you can just beat them down to a point where you think they're just going to continue to take it? Because I don't think so.
Here's an email from Jenny in Jacksonville, Florida. She says, my husband is a truck driver. A few months ago, I found a pay stub of his from 10 years ago, realized he was making more back then than he is now, despite his years of experience, and that he had gone from general freight to more specialized freight hauling. When I asked him about this, he said, because of deregulation, beginning with Reagan, companies are allowed to hire whichever hauling company submits the lowest bid, and there is no floor beneath which they cannot go.
Well, that story is repeated a million times over across this country.
Michael, tell me about your health. How is your health?
My health actually is better than it's been in most of my adult life. I've lost about 60 pounds this year.
Good for you.
And I've discovered these things. I don't know if you've tried them. They're called fruits and vegetables. That's it.
Right.
Incredible stuff. I mean, I have so much more energy. It feels so much better. I think, and I tell people too, especially from the Midwest, where I'm considered twiggy. I say that I'm only laughing because it's so sad. The level of morbid obesity is quite significant in places where, you know, people like me live. And I say to people, listen, this is going to be a while before we have real health care in this country. So I want to see all of you around. And we all have to take care of ourselves.
And here's Mrs. Obama on the cover of this week's Newsweek talking about good diets, yeah. Fruits and vegetables. Yeah. Does that mean you're no longer eating meat, or does it mean you're simply including more fruits and vegetables?
Well, I mean, being from a place like Flint, Michigan, I'm prohibited from ever using the word vegetarian because it's just, I don't want my buddies to beat me up.
So,
but basically, I would say I'm 80% of the time I'm eating primarily grains, fruits, and vegetables.
Are you doing this with the help of a doctor?
No, actually, I read this book called I forget what the name was. It was by this Pritikin is the name of it. Pritikin Diet.
Yeah.
And it's from like the 1970s.
But Pritikin's pretty radical.
What's radical about it is that it says actually carbohydrates, complex carbohydrates,
right,
are very good for you.
Yeah.
And it goes against the sort of, you know, carbohydrates are bad that we've been told for so long. Well, the simple carbohydrates are really bad, the processed food. You should never eat anything that's been processed, you know, white flour, white rice, anything that's had the nutrients and stuff sucked out of it. You have to think of this. If you're eating anything you're eating that's processed food, you have to look at it as it's pre-digested food. You're actually eating food that the corporation has chewed up for you. and you're paying them sums of money to then essentially put it into your mouth like a bird to its little chick. So I think that, yeah, people should check it out. I mean, the Pritikin thing is pretty simple. It's not so much a diet as it is just
eat better.
That's what grandma told you to do.
Yeah,
eat your fruits and vegetables and go out for a walk.
And do you give Michelle Obama some credit?
Oh, absolutely.
For pushing this?
Oh, my God. I think this is one of the best things she's doing. The garden that she's grown out there. I mean, she's incredible. We're so lucky to have her. But trust me on this. Again, because we have a capitalist system that is about the profit motive, the large corporations that have fed us this crap for so long and have made so many billions of dollars from it, they're not going to go quietly into the night.
But the other problem, Michael, is that fruits and veggies are expensive. And sometimes feeding a family out of a fast food shop
absolutely
is cheaper than buying good fruits and veggies.
And that's the real crime, isn't it? That we've set up a system that allows it for it to, for essentially the poor and the working class. And that's why those of us who come from this suffer this kind of obesity, because we've been sold a bill of goods that aren't proper for us. And until when more people start eating the fruits and vegetables and the whole grains and these things, the price, like it does with anything, will go down.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's a caller in Washington, D.C. Andy, you're on the air.
Thank you. This is a wonderful program. It's interesting to hear Michael Moore talking about Michael Moore. I guess I would call myself a Marxist, and I liked your capitalism a love story, but I thought it was a very, very Catholic movie in a good way.
You mean small C Catholic?
Huh?
Small C Catholic, you mean?
Yeah. Well, I thought also, I mean, that, as you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, that came through really clear.
I see.
What I didn't hear in it, I think that there are structural reasons why capitalism is not even working for the capitalists. And I think it's one of the reasons that they're throwing their money into the finance sector of the economy, because they can't figure out a way to make money doing the old stuff. They stopped being able to make a lot of at least new money, new investment in about 1990 in the real economy.
I think that what it's not that they weren't making money, it's that they wanted to make more money. And so what we've done, you're right.
Lots more money.
Right. And so we now have a whole generation of young people who've become adults who've been taught that the best way to make money is off money, as opposed to coming up with the next great invention, the next computer, the next light bulb, or finding the cure for cancer, or any of these things that where you would be rewarded if you made a contribution to society. But we don't make things anymore. We don't invent things. We're not moving the society forward as a result of this, because we've just been moving money around, allowing people to play with money, and this is how you're going to make more money.
But you're not giving up on us.
In what way?
You're not giving up on this country in that.
I'm not giving up on this country at all. In fact, I say at the end of this film, I don't like any of this that's going on, and I'm not going anywhere, because I believe I am part of that majority that grew up believing that this country was ours, we the people. And so I'm going to continue to do this.
How are you going to get people moving again? How are you going to get them to come up with a new computer or a new kind of telephone or a new kind of shoe or a new kind of something that we can make here?
Well, I'm in the process of working on a couple of things. I can't really talk about today, but to do this.
Oh, I wish you would.
Well, because I don't have it. I'll have an announcement in the next year or so of some things I'm going to be doing in Michigan.
Good.
To actually do that very thing, because I live in Michigan. I live in the state with the worst unemployment, and I see this happen on a daily basis. Some of the calls that you've taken here today from people who are suffering, I live amongst it. I can't take it anymore. And so I and others are going to do things. Listen, we come from a state that gave Henry Ford, Thomas Edison grew up in Port Huron, Michigan, Berry Gordy from Motown. You go down a whole list of people. Michigan has given the world a lot of things, and we're suffering right now. And I think that, you know, I know there's a way out of this, but it's gonna take us unshackling ourselves from the chains of Wall Street and these banks.
And Michigan also gave us Michael Moore, his latest film, Capitalism, A Love Story, now on DVD. So good to meet you.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me on a show that I listen to on a daily basis, a place where America can have a conversation. Thank you for that.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.